Dale Ahlquist is back with us today. He is head of the Chesterton Society and a renowned expert on all things Chestertonian. There is a new edition of Chesterton's book, The Everlasting Man, which Dale has edited and introduced, is here to explain. Welcome. Welcome, Dale. We're on a first name basis now. Welcome, Dale.
God bless you, Mark. Thank you. Great to be with you.
Now, you call this book Chesterton's masterpiece. How is it relative to his other works in the corpus?
Well, one of the points I make in the book is that he had more than one masterpiece.
Right.
He had several masterpieces. And so we could have said a guide to one of G.K. Chesterton's masterpieces, but that it just doesn't have the same ring to it, Mark.
True. But it is a masterful study.
It is indeed.
A hefty book. You give the book a primary intention, and that is to get people, quote, to see Christianity for the first time. How do we see it for the first time? How do we do that?
So
apart from reading the book.
Yeah, well, it comes with Chesterton's opening chapter that too many people are too close to Christianity to see it, and they have to back up far enough away from it to see it. It's as if he makes the comparison to the hills in England that have big chalk drawings on them that are ancient, and they can't really be seen except from a distance. If you're right on top of the chalk drawing, you don't see the figure that you're sitting on. And so his point about Christianity is too many people are too close to it, and all they know about it is the one thing that affects them that they're close to, and they don't see Christianity in its entirety. And they're reacting against that one thing, and they are usually rejecting Christianity because of the only close contact they have with it. So what Chesterton does in the book is he gets us to back up way back to see not only all of Christianity, but the whole history of the world. He takes us through B.C. and A.D.
All right. Give us the genesis of the book. When, where, and why did Chesterton write it?
So he wrote it in 1925, and that's when it was published. He probably spent a few months writing it. He wrote very quickly. And the book really was very much a reaction to H.G. Wells' book, The Outline of History. And you don't have to have read The Outline of History to understand this complete work in itself. But it helps to know that only because Chesterton points out that H.G. Wells is writing a history of the world, and he leaves out the main character in the story, and that is Jesus. And you can't explain or understand history unless you divide it into two: what happened before Jesus stepped into history and what happened since. And if you try to explain history without that, you are missing the whole point. But his other point in rejecting H.G. Wells' thesis is that H.G. Wells treats man as just another animal. And so the two main points that in the way Chester lays out the book is man is something distinct from all other animals, and Jesus is someone distinct from all other men.
I remember, year 2000, Y2K, and people talking about, how this big event, and not saying anything about the birth of Jesus. I bring this, it's only Y2K because of one man who came along. It sort of didn't quite register with my secular academic colleagues, but they sort of got it. Or when I would say, let's talk about the most influential speech ever given. Blank face. It was called the Sermon on the Mount in some versions. So anyway, but this book, The Everlasting Man, it's not as often read or assigned as our other works. Why is that?
Well, it is a little bit more hefty than some of other Chesterton's works. Most of his books are relatively short, and even they present their own difficulties, because one of Chesterton's great weaknesses is he has too many good lines, and you have to underline the whole book. It makes you stop reading to stop to underline the great quotation that you want to keep, and you realize that you've lost track of what he's talking about because of all these great zingers. And Orthodoxy is a prime example of that. A much shorter book, but people get through the book and they haven't figured out what it was about because they've just underlined the whole book. And with The Everlasting Man, it's a very well and intricately laid out scheme for this book. And it's still hard to get through the first time because he makes so many allusions to events that he assumes everybody knows and to works of literature and classical references that he just assumes his reader is familiar with. And one of the purposes of this book is to fill the reader in on the hundreds and hundreds of references that Chesterton makes.
He says at the start that he has a historical approach, not a theological approach. Well, what is the general subject matter of the book?
Well, the general subject matter of the book is the history of the world. And so that's why he says he's taken the historical approach. But the historical approach is he's trying to recreate for us what happened in the pagan times and how people were trying to make sense out of life and what major events formed the history that we are living in now that affect us directly. And those are, of course, great works of literature, great poetic understandings of the gods through mythology, and the rise of ancient philosophy. And then, of course, the stories of the supernatural that come from the ancient works that seem to be reflecting a reality and not just a superstition.
You know, seeing for the first time, I always remember as an undergraduate, when teacher, always trying to impart how strange Christianity appeared to those Romans, who were curious about it. They weren't persecuting, but just this is very different. And then they could not understand without converting. They couldn't get it from the outside. That is that kind of the first time we need a little of that experience of just how different this is in the world.
That's a great point, Mark, because that's exactly what Chesterton is trying to do. He's trying to describe, how would you describe Christianity to someone who's absolutely never heard of it, never had any understanding of it? And it'll sound strange to someone who is familiar with it if you're explaining it to a total outsider. And a perfect example he uses in the book is this description right here. I'm going to read a little, just a short passage from the book.
Just tell us, what page are you on?
I'm on, this is right under the editor's introduction, XI, but this is an excerpt from the introduction. So it's, out of some dark forest, under some ancient dawn, there must come towards us with lumbering yet dancing motions, one of the queerest of the prehistoric creatures. We must see for the first time the strangely small head set on a neck that not only longer but thicker than itself, as the face of a gargoyle is thrust upon a gutter spout, the one disproportionate crest of hair running along the ridge of that heavy neck like a beard in the wrong place, the feet each like a solid club of horn, alone amid the feet of so many cattle, so that the true fear is to be found in showing not the cloven, but the uncloven hoof. And I have my seniors at Chesterton Academy read that chapter, that passage, and I say, what's he describing? And you get all kinds of answers. He's describing a dinosaur, a monster, a human, a giraffe, a bull, a wolf, a dog, and only, you know, one out of 100 gets it right. He's describing a horse.
Right.
And you've never heard a horse described that way. And so what he's doing now in the rest of the book, he's describing Christianity in a way that you won't recognize it, so that it will seem exactly, as you said, as strange as it must have sounded to the first people who were exposed to it.
Hmm. You say Wells is sort of at the background a little bit. What did H.G. Wells think of Christianity?
Well, he was a total skeptic and a total materialist, so he had no no credibility given at all to supernatural explanations of anything.
Yeah.
And his life, of course, reflected someone who didn't want to believe in God because he lived a very immoral life as well. But ironically and wonderfully, G.K. Chesterton and H.G. Wells maintained a friendship throughout their lives, a very close friendship. And even though they disagreed about everything, truly, they spent weekends at each other's houses. And
Did Wells think that Christianity was pernicious or just kind of a silly superstition?
Yeah, I wouldn't say he would say it was pernicious. I think he dismissed it completely as a superstition, and just dismissed people who believed in the supernatural as weak-minded.
Yeah, yeah. Chesterton talks about he raised the evolutionist, right? The figure who looks upon the world as from the evolutionist standpoint. And he talks about this figure staring at a caveman's cave wall and not being able to understand the pictures that have been drawn. What is the blindness of the evolutionist there that he's pointing out?
The blindness there is that, you know, Chesterton says, you know, the evolutionist just has to really speculate completely upon the prehistory of man for the simple reason that it's prehistoric. It's before what was actually recorded. He says there's only, so all these speculations about the behavior of the so-called caveman, really don't have any foundation or any proof for them. They're just truly speculations. There's only one thing that we know for certain about the caveman, and that's that he was an artist. Hmm. And other animals are not artists. Other animals do not draw pictures. Hmm. And this, he goes, that's a great line. Art is the signature of man. It's the first thing that we see that makes man distinctive from the other animals.
You pull pieces out and make them epigraphs to the different chapters. I should add that there is an editing machinery that you add to the text that explain references, and you've got little summaries as well. Let me give you another line from Chesterton. Let you gloss that. He says, quote, "It is not natural to see man as a natural product." Can you pull that out, explicate that for us? Yeah. It is not natural to see man as a natural product.
So it's a typical Chesterton paradox, you know, along the lines of if we worship the natural, we become unnatural, and if we worship health, we become unhealthy. So he says it's unnatural to look at man as merely natural. You simply cannot account for the uniqueness of the human creature as simply a product of chance and of, you know, random changes that result in things like Shakespeare. It just simply is not an adequate explanation. And everyone knows that. It's simply common sense to look at man and realize this is a something different from all of other nature. And he says, for those who try to maintain that explanation, they just simply have too much work to try to explain everything that has happened in human history as purely the result of natural godless forces. It's not a product of nature.
One of the ironies that Chesterton frequently brings out is that these enlightened skeptics figures who accuse the believers of a certain narrow-mindedness or closed-mindedness are themselves a lot more dogmatic than believers tend to be. He actually contrasts the dogmatism of the Darwinists with the looser, maybe agnosticism of Darwin himself. Is he saying Darwin would have objected to the places where the Darwinists had taken his theories?
I think there's a good case to be made that he would have. Chesterton has a great reference to The Origin of Species. He says many people are under the impression that they've read The Origin of the Species because they really haven't. Darwin makes references to the creator in that book, so he obviously does believe in God. He had a troubled theology, and part of it was his own encounter with a lot of hypocritical Anglicans who didn't impress him as moral people, but it's not clear that that he would have held to his own explanation or suggestion, rather, of natural history as dogmatically as his followers did. And I think he was really radicalized by Thomas Huxley, is what he was. Thomas Huxley needed Darwin to justify his own agnosticism.
Hmm. He says that there's a lot of people, you know, writing during this time about the origins of religion. And Chesterton sort of says, well, why is it that all these people studying the origins of religion want to come up with explanations that are just going to explain it away? You know, they're motivated. And it biases, it colors their researchers. You can't trust them. They want to find materialist or psychological explanations for it all the time. In the next section on the antiquity of civilizations, Chesterton draws his own distinction between civilization and barbarism, which turns upon the authority of spirit. Right? What is the distinction?
Well, civilization is an orderly way of living where people live under conditions of self-control, recognize laws, and building an actual culture with a heritage to it. Barbarism is based on the appetite. It's based on taking and taking from other things that have been established before it, and is usually an attack on civilization. So it's either a rejection of or an attack on, and Chesterton demonstrates that throughout history. After a great civilization has fallen, the barbarians run wild for a while until a new civilization rises.
Hmm. In your commentary in that section, you at one point you summarize one point of Chesterton's by asserting, quote, comparative religion is impossible.
Yeah.
How so? Why is that?
So when we generally compare religions, we make out a chart and we try to compare all the different elements in the chart, starting with the founder of the religion. And so you have, you put, Moses or Muhammad or Buddha and then Jesus. And you realize right away there's going to be a problem in comparing them, because Jesus makes one claim that none of the other founders of their religions claim. He claims to be God, and all of a sudden the comparisons are starting to fall apart at that point, and so Chester completely gives us a new chart for comparing the developments of history and shows how religion fits into each of these developments, but throws away the typical column chart. And I think it's one of the most creative tools he uses in the book. I won't explain it now because you have to read it to see it. But comparative religion is difficult because because they don't compare well when one of the founders is claiming to be God.
Right. What does it mean to say, quote, Christ didn't found a religion, he founded a church?
Yeah, so a church is something different from a religion, and Chesterton makes those distinctions. A church has a different structure to it than a religion. And his explanation of that is really, really profound. You could say religions have practices, churches have practices, religions have rules, churches have rules, but the church is something distinct in that you have a relationship with a person in that church, and that that main figure of the religion is going to be present in the practices that are clearly laid out and that binds the people in a different way than merely ascribing to the same belief as other believers.
Yeah. I mean, to found a religion suggests that it's almost like you're inventing God, right? You're starting now, but no, Christianity's always been there. It just needs a church. So,
and I think one of Chester's great insights that C.S. Lewis builds off this too, as he borrows absolutely everything from Chesterton, is that the world can be really split into two religions. Really, ultimately, there is the Western and the Eastern, and every other religion, every variant, is going to be a variant of one of those. And Christianity is going to be the Western religion, and the Eastern religion is epitomized by Buddhism. And the ultimate goal of Christianity is communion with God. And the ultimate goal of Buddhism is the suppression of all desire, nirvana, which is a nothingness. So they are absolutely at opposite extremes.
Now, it seems that Chesterton does admire a lot of these comparative religion, cultural anthropologists, these guys, you know, late 19th century, you know, going around the world collecting artifacts and studying, you know, these remote cultures and their local religions, such as James Frazer, for their bare inquiry, right, of collecting myths and folklore in faraway places. But is it say that the problem is they're trying to interpret all of these around some unified field theory of belief? Is that right? Is that the mistake that they make?
Yeah, the great religious anthropologists, I guess, is the way to describe them.
Yeah,
are trying to say that everything is basically the same, all has the same origin, and all ultimately believes the same thing, and they're the ones who do comparative religion. Now, Chesterton does admire their work, and it does admire their insights, as he does with everybody who has a good idea. But he will acknowledge what we have in common with such thinkers and where they vary from a correct understanding of things. So he's always providing a corrective for bad theories.
Yeah. Well, in my undergraduate atheist days, I liked reading, you know, Frazer on the, you know, the volume on, quote, dying and reviving gods. And I said, oh, there you go. Jesus is just another one of these figures that gets planted and comes back, you know, some nature deity. So there was a certain, you know, pleasure I took in that as a takedown, and I was wrong. So, but there's an interesting line in chapter 6. Nature is always looking for the supernatural. Can you give us a gloss on that one?
Yeah, lovely, another lovely line. But Chesterton has really great high regard for paganism. You know, paganism, the pre-Christian attempt to find God, and before revealed religion. And of course, the pagans being apart from the Hebrew people who did have the revelation of the true God. But his argument is the pagans are, paganism is the natural religion. It's trying to personify natural events such as the sun and the moon and the seasons by putting something supernatural behind them, because man is looking for an explanation of these things that happen. He wants to have meaning to his life and meaning to the natural phenomena that he observes. And he's always looking for a better explanation. The myths are the poetic explanations of what happens. And it's not, he says, it's not that, well, Chesterton doesn't say this, this is just the right interpretation. It's not that the myths aren't true, it's that they are always true. They're always, that's why we can return to them again and again, because they are telling, you know, the story that we all observe over and over again, and they put it in such a way that it always is relevant. But it never is a completely satisfying explanation of things. So the natural religion is truly looking for the supernatural.
And Chesterton goes into demons in this section. Who are the demons?
So the demons are exactly what you imagine. At a certain point, Chesterton says, people will turn to witchcraft and to other supernatural means because they can get results. And that is the reality of a supernatural that mankind has turned to again and again throughout history is they understand the reality of the dark side, and that that's a very real thing. And Chesterton brings the demons into history in some of the foulest of all civilizations where demon worship has been practiced.
Yeah. And then there's nature worship, you know, just sort of a not supernatural nature worship, which Chesterton says always ends up producing unnatural things and behaviors.
Yeah.
Why is that? Well, what's the argument there?
You know, it's kind of what St. Paul says when you start worshiping the creature instead of the creator. And Chesterton brings it out very well that when we start worshiping nature as the ultimate, we again will not be fulfilled, but we will start to engage in really self-indulgent activities. And he says, you know, the fall of paganism, the fall of the myths, is that it ends up in a just a complete erotic decay.
Chesterton turns to the life of Jesus here on earth, and he makes much of where Jesus was born and also the homelessness of the Holy Family. I mean, this is a historical event in a particular place, particular time. Why does he emphasize this so much? What does he conclude from it?
He's certainly been talking about the Roman Empire at the end of the first part of the book. And you know, the last reference in part one is, and then there was this obscure thing that happened at the very edges, at the very last outpost of the Roman Empire. And there was this disturbance there. And then he starts to unwind what happened. Where did this group of Christians come from? And so he takes us to the beginning of that story. And there's a great parallelism with he starts out as the man in the cave, the caveman, but now it's the God in the cave, because the traditional understanding of the stable is that it was a cave. It was a hollowed out piece of rock where the animals stayed. And even he says, you know, under the earth it could be. And so Chesterton says, you know, God comes to us from under the earth. It's a really shocking way of looking at Christianity and the, you know, the nativity story in a surprising way that we've never thought of before, because Chesterton is trying to get us to see it in a new way, because we think we're so familiar with this story, but it's a lot stranger than we think.
And you know, just thinking about this, Dale, it would just sound off if Jesus were born in a nice little cottage that Joseph and Mary owned. They're a nice little piece of bread. Something about the homelessness, the place. I mean, it's a place, but it's not been so humanized. I mean, that fits. I'm not even sure why.
Well, you know, he makes reference to the drawings of the animals on the cave, in the caveman story. Well, now these animals have come to life in the cave where God himself comes into the earth. And there's that poetic parallelism there again. But also, I think one of the most wonderful lines is that the hands that created the stars and the moon were too small to reach the huge heads of the cattle. That would be great on a Christmas card.
That's good. Yeah.
Chesterton has turned everything that we thought about upside down, because he is this master of paradox, and he says the truth is going to be unexpected.
Yeah.
First of all, it's unexpected God becomes a man. That's unexpected. It's unexpected he would come as a baby.
Let me ask last question on that. Why the title, The Everlasting Man?
Yeah, that's really interesting, Mark, because that phrase is never used in the book at all. And it could almost be a double meaning to the title. Obviously the reference to Christ himself, but to mankind. That there's something eternal that was planted when that first man walked the earth. And because that represents a relationship with God. Because if God is the creator, and he's created something in his own image, he's created something everlasting because he himself is everlasting. So it's a lovely double meaning to that phrase.
Well, there it is, The Everlasting Man, a new edition, edited by Dale Ahlquist. Thank you, Dale, for joining us.
Great pleasure, Mark.